getting heavy. Come on, settle down, lean back and unwind, 'cause we're getting tuckered.
Hey, everybody, welcome to another episode of ADD Storytelling, a podcast in which we explore the myths and legends of our time, the past, the present, the future, your order, and sometimes with less than perfect focus. I'm Tucker.
Oh, God.
I'm joined, by, as always,
you yelled.
By our beautiful, radiant.
But look at the sound.
Yeah, there's a bit of a spike there. I'm joined by my wife, Maddie. How's it going, Maddie? We're off to a good start. Yeah. It's a Tuckered Out episode. This is the energy I'm bringing.
It's Tuckered Out.
Yep.
Tucker's in charge of it.
Yeah.
We've only had one creative difference so far.
There's been about three. I count three.
Three?
Yeah, there's been ethics in researching. There's been my Italian accents. Don't do them. And me fiddling with cables.
The third one is just so it saves me on editing and so that when we're talking, we can't hear random noises.
Yeah.
That's not really a creative difference.
Well, it's part of my process to fiddle with cables. I'm like a cat. My cats growing up would always eat, like, all the cables. I'd never have a working video game controller. Anyway, that's not what we're discussing today. God, that's a big spike in the audio back there. Comparatively. Anyway.
That was when you yelled your name.
Yeah. Tuckered Out episode. Yeah. Well, Maddie, do you know what we're talking about today? Or what I'm going to be talking about? Because I'm mainly going to just be talking at you. What's it about?
I guess men without heads.
Dudes with no heads. Yeah, pretty much.
What did you want me to say about this again?
Just how much fun you have editing the Tuckered Out episodes. It's so easy on you.
I did have fun editing it, but I did have to cut out 40 minutes of the last episode to make it linear.
Coherent?
Linear. I'm going to say linear.
Okay. I feel like my choice of words is probably more accurate, if a little more truthfully said.
It turned out great. Everyone loved it.
Everyone. All three listeners loved it. Anyway, getting into it, staying on target. We're talking today about headless folks. Oh, Maddie's first yawn. There we go. All right, that's number one. We'll count. Yep, today we're talking about headless folks, and it's going to be a history and analysis of what they are, where they came from, what they mean, and how they appear across cultures. Because there's a few of them. People got stories about headless folk. And so to start us out, we're going to go to a little literary references. This first one comes from an obscure backwater writer named Shakespeare. This is the Bard's Bard, for those unfamiliar with that name. He included a passage about what we're going to be calling today the Blemmy, as they're known in medieval Europe mythology, being the headless men. Yeah, Shakespeare, that fun hipster, included a reference in his 1604 work titled Othello. And Maddie, if you would like, here's a little snippet you can read for the listeners to keep you awake.
And portents in my travels history, wherein the antris vast and deserts idle, rough quarries, rocks, and hills whose heads touch heaven, it was my hint to speak, such was the process. And of the cannibals that eat each other eat, the anthropomorphagi,
no.
And men whose heads do grow beneath their shoulders, Act 1, Scene 3.
Yes. So here we have a reference to the anthropophagi. It was a good try, Maddie. That word sucks.
What did I say?
Anthropomorphagi? I think you added a morph in there.
I don't know.
Which I understand. I heard you like start out, and you're like, nah, fuck it. I'm going to make this into something I'm fairly familiar with saying.
I don't know.
Yeah, you made it your own. I appreciate that.
Still can't remember what you said was the right way to say it.
Anthropophagi, I believe?
Anthropophagi.
I believe.
Okay.
Because, all right, we'll touch on that now. So, I've already said blemmies. In this writing, that's yawn number two for Maddie. Blemmies. Shakespeare says anthropophagi. There are others in Europe that call them the acephali, which is spelled annoyingly A-C-E-P-H-A-L-I. Reading that, I kept saying internally, Acephali. But then when I was watching some videos on the great academic resource YouTube, they all said Acephali. I don't know. Just a bunch of stupid names for these headless boys. And they're all hard to pronounce. So, not only does Shakespeare mention them, calls them the anthropophagi, and also mentions how they're cannibal, which is a recurring theme in these stories. The Blemmy are usually giants, by which I mean, like, 6-7 foot. So giants to Europeans, who are just wee, so, stout little folk.
Like Ben Kissel?
Yeah. Descriptions of the Blemmy. So tall. I feel like I've been remiss not to mention this earlier. Big defining characteristic. Their eyes are usually in their shoulders or on their chest, with their mouth located around their navel. That's a fairly big point that I left out. I was just saying headless. More so than headless, they got chest face. That's the big thing. I really should have led with chest face. Because up until this point, if I was going in blind, I'd just be like, all right, they're just people without heads. That's not all that interesting.
Chest so are they, face.
They're zombies?
Yeah, no, they have their mouth where their stomach is.
Yeah, that's the
They have their
whole
eyes
thing.
Where nothing is.
And, where nothing is. Well, that is poetic.
Yeah, they have their eyes
does,
on their chest, which is where seeing comes from the heart.
No,
have their nose in the middle of that region, somewhere next to their sternum, because it's close to the lungs.
Maddie, share with the listeners the fact that you do always refer to the breasts as the void of the body.
It's not
the areas where nothing is.
You're making that up.
You're always saying the chesticles are the void.
Nobody says that.
You say it. Yeah, no one else says it.
I don't like it when you make things up about me. Remember, that's a condition.
That's a condition. We are storytellers, though.
Not so anyway. About me. Not about me.
Not about me!
I'll cut that all out.
No! These fun lads have face chests. Forgot to mention that. So, what we got? Tall. Face chest.
No head.
Yeah, right, because the face is in the chest. Cannibalistic.
Are they all cannibalistic?
For the most part.
So wait, here's the question, though. Are they considered to be human things?
They're humanoid.
Humanoid, but not human, actually.
We'll get into that. So other than that good Shakespeare boy, got another reference to him coming from Lewis Carroll, who drew inspiration from the wood carvings of Blemmy. Found along the walls of the Ripon Cathedral in New Yorkshire.
Hey, it's my hometown.
It's not, though. It's in London.
Ripon.
England.
R-I-P-O-N. Ripon.
Yeah.
Go there if you're interested.
Good lord, why would you do that?
Maybe if you vote red in the elections and you like Modesto and it's suburb equivalent, you can move there. Or move back.
Just
as
plug the almonds.
Oh yeah, almonds. We have
That's
those.
Mainly what you got. You got Almonds and Jeremy Renner. Lead with that.
Jeremy Renner's from Modesto.
Right.
We have a lot of Dutch people. If you're Dutch, you can move there. Also Portuguese. Yep.
Today's episode brought to you by the city of Ripon. It's a Ripon good time. Anyway, so yeah, Lewis Carroll saw Blemmy in the cathedral where his pop-up worked. His pop-up was a cannon. What does that mean? Do you know? Oh, Maddie's struggling to hold back another yawn.
Stop commenting.
Maddie, as someone that went to church, can you tell me what a canon is?
No, I can only guess about what a canon means. Like, maybe it's someone that keeps the tails, but I have no idea.
That makes sense. I'll allow that. And then moving on, because those are the two kind of literary references I had. We got Shakespeare. They're all over. Like, if you look in European manuscripts, especially medieval ones, you see them quite frequently. You probably all, like, have something in your mind as I'm talking about chest-faced people. Hopefully, maybe. Or I'm coming out of left field hot here.
But maybe everyone's thinking of Jigglypuff. Cannibalistic Jigglypuff.
God damn.
What does Jigglypuff eat?
Ass.
They ask too much on our explicit podcast.
So aside from those two fancy boys, Carol and Shakespeare, hopping around all jolly old London town talking about chest-faced boys. The term blemmy is a demonym, which is a term that identifies a group of people in relation to a particular place. In this case, the term blemmy referred to a broad and diverse region of people that inhabited the Eastern Desert, or Sahara Desert, located to the east of the Nile River. One source claims that the actual people known as the Blemmies were said to be named anonymously after King Blemmis, according to Nonnus' 5th century...
King Blemmis. Mr. Blemmis, come here.
Daddy Blemmis.
Do you think it's a long-lost relative of Elaine Bennis? Bennis Blemmis? Blemmis Bennis.
It's daytime, but I heard a cricket outside.
It was a bird.
Yeah, I know. There it is again.
Tweet, tweet.
Now I'm just thinking about Elaine. I get a lot of joy thinking about Elaine.
I like it when she kicks.
Maddie do be liking it when Elaine kicks. Anyway, so yeah, King Blemmis, but no lore about headlessness is attached to that dude. So, you know, might just be circumstantial? I don't know. However, inscriptions found near the city of Aswan in Lower Egypt give us a relatively in-depth understanding of the Blemmian kingdom which thrived in late antiquity. Though some of the more well-actually-leaning historians of yore contend that...
Well-actually.
Thank you, Maddie. Contend that the use of the term kingdom is somewhat dubious, as there is evidence that the society may actually have been broken into numerous factions that functioned within a political hierarchy, rather than answering to a central government.
Wow, that was really good.
I know, it's almost like I'm used to it.
It's almost like you identify as the well-actually kind of...
Blemmian society is generally accepted as sharing a strong sense of identity in connection to the ethnic cultural group known as the Beja, who continue to inhabit land in modern-day Egypt, Sudan, and Eritrea. Always, every time, stumble on the word Eritrea. The name, the place, the country.
Okay, that's interesting because it's kind of given to this group of people for no apparent reason.
Well, we'll get into that. So, which actually brings me to a quote from Daryl Percival, who writes in their folklore blog, Into the Wonder, on Blogspot, how a real-life human population came to be seen as headless monstrosities is anybody's guess. Certainly, the nearly universal human tendency to demonize and dehumanize one's enemies is at play.
Oh,
which
so
I'm going to be going into here.
Racism.
Yeah! Ding, ding, ding! That being said, I still found it to be interesting and prudent to talk a little bit about the actual, truthful, factual Blemmian culture, rather than just focus entirely on the creatures. So that being said,
how much are you going to really say about it? Are you identifying your podcast as our more bedtime story-ish episodes?
Yeah, it's tuckered out. It's time to get sleepy.
It's time to get sleepy. That's your goal in making these?
No.
Or are you just saying that because...
Things that I generally find interesting.
I'm always sleepy.
Well, they're two sides of the same coin. You are always sleepy. And I find topics interesting that most people would be put to sleep by. So, very roughly, around 1000... There's the yawn. Around 1000 BC, a group of people referred to in the archaeological texts as the Sea Group. Wildly interesting. Cool. Couldn't bother to even just make something up. Sea Group. Migrated from Lower Nubia.
Nubia would be a cool thing to go over because it's one of the more, like, ancient wonders of the world that have been, like, stamped out as being, like, really interesting and sophisticated ancient cultures. Like, Nubia is supposed to be... Yeah, but, like, nobody talks about it. They always talk about Rome and all that bullshit. But, like, this was way earlier.
Oh, yeah.
So that's interesting.
So, Sea Group, as they were so, you know, creatively named, migrated from Lower Nubia, the area between present-day Aswan and Wadi Halfa in Egypt, and settled in Upper Nubia, the Nile Valley north of Dongola in Sudan, where they developed the kingdom of Napata from around 750 BC. For some time, this kingdom controlled Egypt too, supplying its 25th dynasty. The landscape from which the Blemmian people originated and wherein they made their living as farmers, miners, scouts, and warriors was largely an inhospitable one. For centuries, this area became so arid and dry On account of receding water levels along the lower Nile, the desert agricultural practices were virtually impossible. Considered a no man's land from 600 BC to the first century AD, up until the Sakia water wheel was invented, and farming was once again made viable in this environment. This is the bread and butter of what I was talking about, where it's like things that I find interesting might be wildly boring. But that's me. I read that and was like, gotta include that. And looking back at it,
the water wheel used.
I was like, oh hell yeah, that's fun. This land was arid and inhospitable, and then they made a thing. And they're like, we can live here.
Water wheels, though.
Yeah. So military might, conflict, and allegiance with Roman emperors, both as conscripts and invaders. Flemish society boasted military might and was also wrought with conflict and allegiances to the Roman emperors, as well as occasionally working with them. In 193 AD, during what was called the Year of the Five Emperors, the Roman Emperor Pescinius Niger enlisted the Blemmyae in an attempt to eliminate his competition, Septimius Severus, which is just a kick-ass name. It's a very good name, especially if we're talking villains. Alternative.
Septimius Severus?
Septimius Severus. Right? That's good shit. Okay. Alternatively, the armies of the Blemmyan people made numerous raids against Roman outposts and settlements along the northern coast of modern Egypt. So, it's this funny kind of on-again, off-again relationship between the Blemmyes and the Romans, where sometimes they were their hired help mercenaries, and other times they were raiding them and just completely breaking their shit down. Though often successfully pushed back by the Roman occupiers, after one defeat at the hand of the Roman prefect Firmus, the Blemmyan fighters were enlisted to fight alongside said Firmus in a revolt against the Palmyran Empire in 273 AD. The city of Palmyra was the capital of the Palmyrene Empire during the so-called Crisis of the 3rd century, in which a second breakaway Roman Empire was founded. Save for its lack of cryptids and folkloric elements, I would absolutely love to dive into that story, because it's pretty weird and wrought with a bunch of good juicy drama and hot goss. So maybe in a future Tuckered Out, if we really want to get sleepy, I'll talk about the crisis in the 3rd century.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, you look excited. But I dipped my toe in there, and I was like, ooh, this is some sleepy water. I can take a bath in that. I have a whole little thing here where I'm like, hey, the Blemmyes were fun, kind of reminded me of Dune. But I decided, you know, even when I wrote it, I was like, I don't know if I want to do that to Maddie.
Go ahead.
They remind me of the Fremen, because they're these badass, like, they're a culture that, like, adapted and learned to survive in the worst of conditions. Constantly being invaded and trying to be fucked over by occupiers and colonizing elements from Europe and the Mediterranean. But they resisted and fought back and knew the terrain better than anyone. They're essentially the Fremen. And it made me really stoked when I was reading this.
The Blemmyes are the Fremen.
Yeah. Blemmy Fremen. King Blemmyes.
Fremmy Blemmen.
King Blemmyes the Fremen. King Blemmyes the Fremen. How did the term Blemmy evolve from the title of an entire diverse group of people mentioned in the historical record up until the 8th century, into what we now know as a group of cannibalistic, evil, sometimes yellow cryptids?
Sometimes Maddie. Yellow, you yeah, say. Yeah.
Did I not mention that earlier either?
Uh-uh.
Yeah. Sometimes they're yellow.
Okay.
Which I just find delightful. They're referred to solely as anthropophagi in it. In one of my favorite book series, Brian Catling refers to... There's the anthropophagi or main presence in a fictionalized version of the Garden of Eden, and they're yellow, and it's fun. And the book series is called The Vor. It's very good.
Oh, of course, it's The Vor. I was like, what book series are you talking about?
The Vor.
And it's The Vor.
The Vor is fantastic.
It's very much something Tucker likes. If you like what Tucker likes,
you'll love like The Vor. Yeah, it's trippy. Very good. Terry Gilliam recommends it, so you know it's weird.
Who is that?
Terry Gilliam from Monty Python?
Oh.
He also directed,
like... Am I supposed to care?
Brazil... Whoa! No. So, theories regarding the origin of the fictional Blemmy and its appearance. Let's get into them.
This is what I want to know.
Yeah?
Okay.
All right. So, one theory. It comes from a particular fighting style, wherein warriors would march into the battle with their heads tucked low, like, towards their chest. With their shoulders up high. Be kind of like, man, I'll try to do it here. Do I look scary?
So their warrior stance was to become a man turtle?
Yeah. Do I look frightening?
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle.
Teenage man. No. Man-aged Mutant Ninja Turtle.
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah, so that's a theory. What do you think about that?
I think Turtleman is a great possibility. Turtleman fighting technique.
Another
extra turtle.
Extra turtle. All right. Another theory that kind of piggybacks off that last one is that it could come from brightly colored, pretty, for the time, pretty photorealistic depictions and paintings of faces emblazoned on shields carried into battle. Kind of held up in front of the chest, so it looks like they got a face right there.
Oh,
obscuring
I see. Obscuring
the real head.
So their face shield gave them a chest face.
Yeah. That's another idea, which...
Face shield, not just, like in the COVID current thing that we normally say, but a shield that is used for getting rid of weapons, or like...
Deflecting weapons.
Deflecting weapons has a face on it.
Which, I mean, I feel like every time I hear these old-timey...
Face shields?
No, old-timey, like, descriptions of, like, where a story may have originated. Like, even going back to the last Tuckered Out with, like, the Umibozo, and, like, it could have been storm clouds or turtles. It's like, how bad are you?
Hey, the return of the turtle.
Oh, yeah. That's this episode. Head, chest-faced men, the return of the turtle. How, like, bad are your powers of observation if you're just like, look at that man with their fancy shield. Obviously, that's his real operating face, and it's in his chest. I'm going to spread this story
for
generations.
It's coming from the telephone.
Yeah.
The telephone effect of mythology and stories.
I realize that, but... Yeah. So now we get to the third one, which is those that speculate that the Blemmy are misidentified chimpanzees. Because if you think about, like... We've seen those photos of chimps where they're just kind of sitting, and they're super hunched, and they're eating, and their head's kind of just, like, dipped down low.
No.
No?
I really
should have included that in my document here.
That's fine.
Yeah, but just take my word for it, then?
Yeah, I take your word for it.
Chimps hang their head down low. They let them wobble to and fro. Do any of those sound plausible or reasonable to you?
Face shields.
Face shields. Do you like face shields the most?
I liked face shields and I like turtle men.
All right. So yeah, when you're thinking about misidentified chimps and things like that, as well as turtle men, my brain immediately goes to medieval depictions of, say, like elephants and whales. And then we kind of touched on this in the last Tuckered Out with whales looking all weird and old-timey etchings and paintings. But I had a couple examples of such things. Maddie, would you take a gander at this and tell me what you see?
It looks like if someone was describing to you an elephant and you had never seen an elephant before,
mm-hmm.
and you made it kind of look like a dog that has a long nose and tusks.
It's very furry.
It's super furry.
It's kind of got a horse face.
It does. The trunk looks pretty normal.
The trunk's surprisingly
But the rest accurate. Of it looks nothing like it. It looks like a dog.
Yeah, definitely dog. Can't
it looks,
paws.
Yeah, it looks like a dog with an elephant mouth.
And how do you nose. Feel about this?
Is that a fish?
That's a whale. Once again, but mainly dog.
No, it looks like a fish.
Doesn't look like a whale, though, does it?
No, it just looks like a big fish, like a carp or something.
It's got dog face, though. But it's got dog face. Anyway. Moving on. There is one example of a Blemmy paired with a monkey included in a map of the New World, though, to undercut confusing one for the other, I included this. So in 1513, the Ottoman admiral and cartographer Puri Reis depicted a Blemmy off the coast of what is now Brazil in an illustration that shows the creature with its eyes and mouth on its chest, mouth on its stomach, and a dense, bushy beard running up from its armpits to its groin. Reis includes the text describing the creature, which states, "These wild beasts attain a length of 7 spans, which I guess is here, marketed as being 5'3", which seems...
Ooh, that's an inch shorter than me.
It's also extremely... 7 spans is exactly 5'3". The quote goes on, "Between their eyes, there is a distance of only 1 span, 9 inches. Yet, it is said they are harmless souls." Which, so yeah. So these Blemmy, discovered in the New World, well, quote-unquote New World, by this Ottoman cartographer, and as you can see right here, there's a Blemmy, there's a monkey, right next to it. So we knew. They're not the same. See that Blemmy? See the monkey? Different things. So what does this all say, Maddie? It says that they weren't monkeys. They weren't folks with shield chests. They were real living things, and they still exist.
Okay, I was really wondering where were you going with this, because we just started looking at random... Like, to recap, we looked at a picture of a whale, a picture of an elephant, which were not at all related, and then we looked at...
No, they're related in that those are just medieval depictions of animals that were rare, and so often wildly distorted from reality. They're examples of how one thing that... something that we know exists in this world could be misidentified and distorted through, like you said, the act of telephone in medieval times to look like something monstrous and alien. This is all to say, lemmings and apes might not be one and the same, and perhaps instead share a relationship as allies, confidants, pen pals. The truth is out there, and we will discover it together. Come on, talk it out. Though this monkey-centric anecdote is jumping ahead in our story, we still need to discuss how the blemme penetrated European folklore.
Do we? I think it would be through the Greeks and Romans, right? If it's a thing with the...
Yeah, no, Maddie just got it.
Because you said they were fighting with the Romans.
Yeah, that's you put together the following three paragraphs into like one thought. Yeah, it's Roman and Greek races talking about people from Africa and Northern Africa.
All right.
And eventually demonizing them and making them out to be monsters.
Okay.
Maddie got the answer.
Yeah.
So, blemme. Started out as a real group, an ethnic group in Northern Africa, fought against the Romans and the Greek, was eventually described in stories. Specifically translating to without head, acephali were groups labeled as heretics and condemned for their religious practices that were devoid of, quote, a king or a bishop. Essentially autonomous, their personal belief systems would work off of widely held Christian dogmas, and those considered acephali were gradually transformed by folklores and artistic depictions of the groups to become monstrous or undesirables. Essentially, it's propaganda by the church being like, fuck these people that aren't toeing the line. Eventually, coalescing and morphing with tales of the blemme from Northern Africa, anthropophagi, to become synonymous with the headless creature that we know today. Herodotus describes the headless acephali as the dog-headed cynophali, quote, and the man-men and women, besides many other creatures not fabulous, that dwelled in the eastern edge of ancient Libya, according to his Libyan, quote, sources. So it was twofold. It was othering non-white people in Northern Africa that the Greeks and Romans were at war with, and it was also demonizing people that weren't going along with, or people that were splinter groups from conventionally and mainstream Christian beliefs. Isn't that fascinating?
Yes, so fascinating.
You are fascinated, aren't you?
Yes.
That's where we get headless boys. Let's go to India. Want to learn about Kabanda?
Sure.
I bet you do. So, the creature Kabanda, which literally translates to headless torso or headless trunk, is a demon or man-eater.
I like headless trunk.
You like that?
Headless trunk.
Do you want to...
I just visualized someone chopping the top of a tree off and leaving the trunk of it.
But like, really high up?
Yeah.
Because
otherwise it's good. A stump.
Yeah.
So they're leaving the trunk, but they're chopping off all the good stuff.
All the good stuff?
Yeah.
Call the branches on the tree the good stuff?
Yeah.
That's the tree meat?
Yeah.
Nice. Nice. So, right. Creature Kabanda is a demon or man-eater known as Rakshasa in Hinduism and Buddhist mythology. Also gonna get ahead of it right now and say for the remainder of the podcast, I'm gonna be struggling with pronunciation.
Okay.
And specifically when we get to the Chinese fables. Sorry. The following comes from a retelling / translation of the Ramayana, which the Ramayana is one of the two epic tales of ancient Indian culture. This page describes the story of Kabanta, included in the Puranic Encyclopedia by Vetsin Mani. It was translated to English in 1975. So, legend tells of Danu, who was born as a Gandharva, which is a celestial musician, as opposed to the Apsaras, or celestial dancers, who I want to discuss in a later episode in connection with fairies. So he's born as a Gandharva, named Vishvavasu. He was the son of the Gandharva Sri Vishvavasu, or Sri, as we'll say from here on out. Danu was granted immortality by the lord and creator god Brahma after paying penance to promote long life to the deity. Unbeknownst to Danu, Brahma bestowed the prince with the gift of immortality for his deeds, and he then roamed the world in a naive state, wholly unaware of the power bestowed upon him by Brahma.
Wait, he didn't know that he was immortal?
Nope.
Interesting.
Yeah, Brahma left that out.
He's like, BT Dubs, you're immortal now. Just kidding, you don't know.
Yeah. It's kind of like the Apple user agreement, I would assume. Just skipped over it and accepted.
Yes.
So, after one day attacking Indra, the Hindu Vedic deity of storms, lightnings, and floods, as well as the king of Svarga, which is heaven. Very
Svarga.
My pronunciation sounds like something from, like, Scandinavian.
Hmm.
Svarga, heaven, and the devas. Danu was struck down by Indra's Vajrayuda, which is a mythical weapon wielded by the deity. Now I want to get into a description of this weapon, said to have been formed out of the bones of Rishdhika, or Dadhiki. Dadhiki is the name of a celebrated sage who became ready to die, just thirsty for death, and offered his bones to the gods. With these bones, the architect of the gods made a thunderbolt with which Indra defeated Virtra and other demons. That's a cool weapon. And it's also just now dawning on me, this is another connection to the Vor. The Vor, all that book that I mentioned earlier, one of the big things in that is this bow that's made out of the bones and sinews of one of the protagonist's, like, ex-partners. That just ties in entirely with this. Which is kind of fun. Continuing on, Indra's attack on Danu forced the head and thighs of Danu's body into the center of his being, thus reducing him to a Humpty Dumpty-like steak of egg being, or headless DeVito, as I call him.
Wait, is Humpty Dumpty a Blemmy?
No, Humpty Dumpty's an egg man.
But he has a face on his egg face.
Yeah, egg face.
He doesn't have a head.
No, he's a pre-chicken man.
But he's Blemmy-like.
He's Blemmy-adjacent.
Yeah.
I'm just bummed out you're not laughing at Headless DeVito. When I wrote that yesterday...
Headless DeVito?
Yeah, I said, Indra's attack forced the heads and thighs of Danu's body into the center of his being, thus reducing him to a Humpty Dumpty-like state of egg being, or Headless DeVito. That shit's gold.
Sorry.
I chortled to myself when I wrote it.
Hey, you didn't deliver it like a joke, so I just didn't clock it.
Because there's nothing funny about it. It's dead serious. He's a Headless DeVito now.
You mean like Headless Danny DeVito?
Yeah.
Okay.
Danu begged his attacker for a means by which he could stay alive after such a disfigurement, arguing that he would no longer have the ability to feed himself. In response, Indra granted Danu two elongated arms and a mouth upon his chest. Henceforth, Danu assumed the name Kabanta and stalked the forest near the...
The Vor.
We're just going to say the Vor? I'm sorry, y'all. I just can't even begin to pronounce that.
It's the special forest.
I'll try Matangrasrama in Kronsaranya. So it's the name of a forest and then a region. And that is where Kabanta lived after his disfigurement by Indra with the Vajrayuda. So, after the conflict with Indra and the ensuing curse, Kabanta would spend his days engaging in his favorite pastime, terrorizing and attacking the various sages that inhabited the forest in which he dwelled. I wonder now if this part of the legend connects back to the formation of the Vajrayuda and how it was made out of the bones of a sage, if there's some kind of connecting tissue, no pun intended, there, with the weapon that disfigured Kabanta being made from the bones of a sage. I don't know. These are all disparate parts of the story that I was managed to piece together while researching it, because Hindu and Buddhist lore and mythology is it is wildly colorful and deep and so complicated and so well thought out that there's every single topic has about 19 or 20 different side quests that spring off from it. And so this is the most concise telling I can find of this story, where I can at least give some context to each of the players involved. Yeah, I just thought that was interesting, that he hates sages, and that's what he spends his time doing, is bugging them.
Yeah, he hates sages because the sage weapon chopped his head off, and then also... No, I have nothing to say after also. No also.
No worries. Nonetheless, Kabanta continued to roam the wilds, ravaging, haunting, and terrifying those that lived within them on the edges of the map. One day, however, while going to town on a sage in a way that only Kabanta knew how to...
Wait, what? Sorry?
You heard me.
I'm sorry?
Kabanta was going to town on that sage. Just laying into the hermit.
Like, killing him? Or, like, other things?
Going to town.
What does that mean?
The decimated sage looked up into the gruesome visage of his attacker and delivered a curse. The sage told Kabanta that he would forever retain his disgusting Shrek-like appearance until the day that he met Rama, and Rama chopped his fucking hands off. Then and only then would he revert to his original, non-cursed form.
Did they say fucking in the tale?
No.
Is that a yes or a no?
That's a no.
Okay.
I added that in as like a little flourish.
Okay.
It brought you back in. But you're more engaged, because I said fucking. And said that Kabanta was going to town on that lowly hermit.
Yeah, those are things...
Quick side note, Rama, to be wildly concise, is an avatar, one of the many, of the Lord Vishnu, and the main focus of the Sanskrit epics, both the Mahabharata and the Ramayana. He's the main boy there.
Of ancient India.
Mm. Yeah. So, just before we start talking about Rama in connection to this story, I felt like that would be prudent to bring up.
Yeah, he's the big boy.
He's a very... Yeah, he's a big deal. They, I would say, because
they're big
pretty
boy.
Gender fluid.
They're big
over there.
Big
in these tales. Just say not over there.
Big bud.
Yeah, big. Yeah. Keep going.
Big folk guy. Big folk. Big person.
He's the head of this enterprise.
Or is it he or are they?
They. Damn it. That's yeah. Upon entering the.
Wait. Cerise would start. Is it's they right?
Yeah. They. We'll say they for Rama and Lakshmana. Really anyone in the Hindu and Buddhist, what would I call it? Pantheon of characters. I would say they is the better term.
Their gender is fluid?
Pretty much. For example, Indra, who I mentioned earlier, when it comes to this story about Kabanta specifically, every text I read referred to Indra with a female pronoun. But generally speaking, Indra is considered a male god. So it just kind of, it's hard to tell if it's a term, it comes from different local tellings of a story and like how they were written geographically and passed down versus like an actual canon. Because I think there is a lot more kind of loosey-goosey gender fluidity when it comes to the overarching stories. But if anyone has a concrete understanding of that, email us at addstoryteller@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. Upon discovering the demon in the woods, Rama and his brother Lakshmana described the creature as thus. Maddie, you want to take it?
He was thick as a mountain, dark black as a cloud, with pointed hairs all over his body, and looked fierce with a voice as loud as thunder. He had an eye on his stomach, round and yellow, emitting a glare from a fire flame. Looking wicked, he thrust his big tongue out of his huge mouth, licking the sides.
Turn me on now. So, seeing the brothers, Kabanta reached out, groping and twisting his long, sinuous, bulging arms. God damn, I didn't realize how fucking hot this was. Around the two supple brothers. Oh,
it says supple.
I wrote this.
You wrote this. Did you write that?
Yeah, I wrote this, yeah. Sorry.
You didn't realize how hot it was, so you made it hotter, and then you're like, oh, just kidding, I forgot how hot I made this.
God, I'm good.
I forgot that I wrote erotica accidentally.
No, it wasn't accidentally. I was in a state when I wrote this. Kabanta reached out, groping and twisting his long, sinuous, bulging arms around the two supple young brothers. Having been lost in the woods for days, they smelled of cedar, sweat, and blood, all scents that drove the Demon King to near madness as he gripped their rippling, sweat-tinged bodies in his strong hands. Yeah, I
feel like you.
I think you
maybe took it a step too far.
Eventually, and I'll say prematurely, Ramu sliced off Kabanda's right hand. Lakshama cleaved off his left, thus destroying the beast. The brothers constructed a funeral pyre for the creature, and as he burned,
that's nice.
He rose into that's the nice air as a Gandharva king of old. Once again, the celestial musicians. And thus returned to his terrestrial form as a son and prince off to heaven. And that's the story of Kabanta. Another story headless, face-chested figure.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed it greatly.
It was pretty cool.
Yeah. Oh. So, for our third and final chest-headed boy, we're heading to China, where we'll be discussing the legend of Xingqian. Xingqian is one of 10 great demon gods.
Cool.
Isn't it?
Sounds like Inuyasha.
Yeah. Inuyasha's Japanese, though, right?
It is, but a lot of their mythology crosses over due to, like, ancient, like, traveling, like, before they kind of cut themselves off.
Yeah. So, one of the ancient, the great demon gods who served under the Lord Yandi, who was the legendary Flame Emperor of pre-dynastic China.
Flame Emperor like an avatar!
And that's when the Fire Nation invaded. Except, in this story, there's a good guy. Actually, I don't know if there's a good guy or a bad guy in this story. They're just people at war. We'll just leave it
people.
At that. Yeah, it's just people. But yeah, so this is all ancient Chinese history, kind of not, I mean, it's such an old culture that it's hard to say, like.
I mean, it's ancient.
It's ancient, yeah. It's just the.
It's been intact since ancient times.
Roughly, this story comes from around. The story goes that Yandi waged a war against Huangdi, also known as the Yellow Emperor in ancient China. This was one of. Huangdi is one of the deities of ancient northern China, associated with the cultural heroes known as the Three Sovereigns and Five Emperors. And this story of the Three Sovereigns and Five Emperors, in which Xingqian plays a role, is estimated to come from around the time of 2697 to 2597 BCE, around that general area. That's the rough estimation of when this, if there is a human analog for the Yellow Emperor Huangdi, that's when their reign would have occurred. Roughly during that time.
By the way, we like doing CE Common Era and BCE before the Common Era, because that makes more sense.
Yes. Any hoodle. The story goes that Yandi and Huangdi engaged in a conflict over becoming the supreme god. Yandi, who Xingqian, our main character, served, was swiftly and decisively defeated by the Yellow Emperor, which is where our good old and loyal Xingqian steps in. And here on out, we're going to be going to a quick and concise telling of this fable, which comes from a blog called Chinese Aesop, Fairy Tales, Folk Tales, Fables, Myths, Legends, and Historical Stories from China. So, here we go. Without further ado, the story of Xingqian. So, after the Yellow Emperor defeated and executed one of Yandi's other generals, Xingqian went forth with an axe and shield against the Yellow Emperor. He forced his way to the southern gate of the Celestial Court and issued a challenge to the Yellow Emperor for a duel. The Yellow Emperor came forth, and the two engaged in a ferocious combat, sword against axe, all the way down
sword.
To sword. Yeah, I did hit that, didn't
I? Sword.
I did hit sword.
Sworded.
All the way down to earth. Down to earth. They fought from heaven to earth. To the eternally auspicious mountain, the mountain of Chengyang. In a final blow, the Yellow Emperor distracted his opponent with a trick. So I from further readings, I heard that he kind of did the whole turn around and look at that thing. And then,
hey, look over there.
Yeah, that'll chestnut.
Hey, what's that?
Yeah, it's your
smack.
It's your head coming off. And in a flash, decapitated Xingqian, whose head rolled all the way to the foot of the mountain and created a thunderous roar. You know how rolling heads do. Instead of dying, Xingqian was able to continue moving and began groping about for his head. The Yellow Emperor raised his sword to strike the mountain. The mountain split open. The head rolled within, and the mountain closed again. Thus, Xingqian's head was buried forever under the mountain. Xingqian gave up looking for his head, and instead, his nipples transformed into eyes, and his navel became a mouth. He performs a dance with axe and shield in hand.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he became a Blemmy-like thing.
Yeah, well, he became a face-chested boy.
I like how his nipples became his eyes.
Isn't that great? I just perky, taut nipples just turning into eyes.
That makes a lot of sense. If you're thinking about where the eyes are going to be, the nipples makes a lot of sense.
The nipples are the eyes of the chest. I know.
Nipples
we always
are the eyes
say
of
this.
The chest.
It's true.
Yeah.
The lyric poet Tao Qian expressed his commiseration on our tragic hero in the following poem. Would you like to read it, Maddie?
Xingtian dances wildly with spear and shield. His old ambitions still burn fiercely. In vain do they cling to their hearts from the past. How can they, a better day, foresee?
There's a fun little illustration of the guy.
Oh, he's so cute.
He's so good. I also like, there's another telling of this story where kind of folklore about Xingqing after becoming this headless creature, that he was kind of a musician and poet that promoted farming and agricultural practices. But specifically, Xingqing promoted plowing. And I appreciate him for that. The god of plowing.
The god of plowing?
Yeah. His nipple eyes really promote a good plow.
You just really made this sexual, didn't you?
I did. In the end, it just went sexy. So
felt really sexual while you were doing it.
That's what I want to hear. That's my intent. I want to make you tired and horny. Hopefully I've done that today, because I'm rounding out to end this here.
Wow.
But Xingqian, as I see him, is a metaphor for unwavering service, loyalty, dedication, tenacity, and the indomitable spirit. One who literally dances in the face of death and complete destruction, with taut nipples, a full belly, and an axe in hand. He's my kind of boy, and I love him for it. He's great. I love him. Look at that little face.
It looks like he stomps a lot.
So
he likes
cute.
Stomping.
He's heavy-footed. Yeah, he's a good boy. So those are headless boys and headless men and headless folks. From North Africa to the coast of modern-day Brazil to India and to China. We got headless boys all over the place. And now to end it, I want to ask something of Maddie, my delightful co-host. Maddie, who's that Pokemon?
Hitmonlee.
Yeah, Hitmonlee.
Hitmonlee.
A fun modern Blemmy.
He's a modern Blemmy. He's good at fighting.
Just
like
pasted boy.
Just like the guy we just talked about. He's good at fighting.
Yep.
He's a fighting type.
He's a fighting type. And so to close it out, I figured we'd read some entries from the Hitmonlee's various mentions in the Pokedex.
Okay.
Maddie, go to town.
Hitmonlee's legs freely contracts and stretch.
Mm.
Using these spring-like legs, it bowls over foes with devastating kicks.
I didn't realize this was also going to be sexual. Its
After
legs
battle,
can stretch double. First time foes are startled by its extensible reach.
After battle, it rubs down its legs and loosens the muscles to overcome fatigue.
Fuck yeah.
When in a hurry, its legs lengthen progressively. It runs smoothly with extra long, loping strides.
Damn. When kicking, the sole of its foot turns as hard as a diamond. Harder even, if he's sad.
Where did you read that? It looks
in
like you
mind,
made that up.
I did
yeah.
make that up, yeah.
You made that up.
I made that up. The last part. The hard as a diamond was written. I just like that one from Sword there. That's great.
Its legs can stretch double. First time foes are startled by its extensible reach.
And to end it, this is beautiful prose. This amazing Pokemon has an awesome sense of balance. It can kick in succession from any position. Fuck yeah, Hitmonlee. That rules.
And then again, it's, you know what's interesting? This is the same. This is the Sword and Shield. They're like the two that are released at the same time, right? That was from Sword, and then from Shield, it's back to the original. The legs freely contract and stretch. The stretchy legs allow it to hit a distant foe with a rising kick. Yeah. Stretchy legs. He's got some big stretch.
So from ancient times right up until modern releases of Pokemon Sword and Shield, face-chested Blemmies rot with mystery and sexual overtones. But nonetheless,
let's just say double entendre.
I don't think there's anything double entendre about it. It's you know what? It's face value.
Face value sexual?
Yeah, it's right on. It's on the nose. And the nose is on its chest. And Maddie is beginning to throw things at me, so let's call it an episode. Thank you all for joining me. This has been another Tuckered Out. And I think I fucking killed it.
Yeah, great job.
I did so goddamn good.
You're the best.
Do you feel smarter?
I am sometimes smarter.
Do you feel like this is information you would bring up, like, at a work gathering or a date?
Maybe the one about the Pokemon?
Cool.
You could say...
I did the most research for sure on that.
You could be like, oh, Pokemon, and then also, hey, ancient stories in relation to this Pokemon. Isn't that cool? I'm a well-read kind of bruh.
Yeah, that's what they say. Well, what I say is thank you again so much for taking time while you do probably, you know, monotonous work, drive, or...
Dishes,
or...
Driving.
Yeah, you know, when I drive my dishes around, or sit and ponder crimes.
You shoot your dishes in the backyard. With a BB gun.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, while you're doing that, while you're doing yard crimes, I'm glad you're spending that time listening to us and learning bullshit. Because it's good.
Okay, so if you would like to send us your favorite myth of a headless but chest-faceful person, you can go ahead and send it to addstoryteller@gmail.com. If you would like to be a sponsor for our future episodes, go ahead and email that as well.
Especially, even if you don't have a real product and you just want to, like, be a sponsor, that also works. We can just say your name.
You could also support us directly, even if you don't want to be a sponsor, by going to our website and then supporting us on Anchor. Mm-hmm. Monthly subscription type, if you feel like it. Mm-hmm. But most importantly, tell your friends. We need people to listen to this thing, you guys.
Burn cassettes for them.
Yeah. Yeah. Burn cassettes.
Get this shit on their iPod
Print
Mini.
Print out the transcripts.
Yeah. Fucking pour through the microfiche.
I mean.
Get us out there.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you! I'm upset with you now for listening. This has been a great time. I've had a good day.
Yeah, it's
This has been Tuckered Out. And I am your host, Tucker. I'm joined by our beautiful...
No, well, I'm the host.
Right. I've been the speaking person, Tucker.
You were the host, this episode.
Host wife, Maddie. That's it for us today.
You're the co-host.
Okay. Yeah, I'm whatever. I don't know. I'm not sure what my official title is, but I know that I'm done.
Co-host.
Good night.